started in just a second. If you have your Bibles, go ahead and be opening to Exodus chapter 19 as we get started this morning, as we look at the story of the Bible, which really is telling about God's plan to save man from sin. That's the emphasis that we were looking at sort of the main parts of the Bible, the story of the Bible itself, trying to show how those things work together, are pieced together to tell this great story of salvation. And one of the things that we've been looking at as we begin, kind of get your minds going here this morning, we've been talking about five Old Testament key passages. And instead of me revealing them, I'm going to ask, this is a test, so this is a pop quiz. I used to hate those in school. But what is the first key passage of the Old Testament, at least the way we've been looking at it in this class? The first key passage. Yeah, Genesis chapter 3, what happens in Genesis chapter 3? All right, there is the prophecy about Christ, but the overall story in chapter 3, what happens between God and man? Sin. Yeah, that's sort of the emphasis there. Of course, that prophecy is mentioned, and that is important, but it's that idea of sin which separates man from his God, and that sets up the problem for us. So the second key passage in the Old Testament would then be what? Yeah, Genesis 12, thank you, which tells about the promise to Abraham, where God promises a solution to the problem of sin, that all the nations of the earth will be blessed through the seed of Abraham, and we'll be, of course, talking about that. Now, we come to our third key Old Testament passage, and that is Exodus chapter 24. You don't have to turn there yet, but we're going to be looking at Exodus 24. And that is the place where God ratifies, or He completes, the covenant that He is about to establish with Israel, where the covenant is actually made. And we're going to be talking about that this morning and trying to emphasize of why that's so important. Because, there's a lot of reasons that we'll be emphasizing. And, of course, there are two other key passages that we will eventually get to. But let's talk about a little bit about the covenant. In general terms, what is a covenant? I mean, we use it quite a bit in our, I guess, religious discussions. We don't typically use the word covenant outside of religious or spiritual conversation. But what is a covenant? Okay. I think that the very basic idea of a covenant is an agreement where there are promises that are made, where there are typically two parties involved, and both parties say that they're going to do something, an accord is struck, if you will, an agreement is made, and they enter into this relationship based on this covenant. And that's what we're going to see here in Exodus 24. Now, there's all different types of covenants. The Old Testament, when I talk about the Mosaical Law, I mean, you could have marriage as a covenant. Is that correct? Marriage is a type of covenant that the two parties enter into an agreement of sorts, and they enter into a special relationship. You know, businesses could enter into a covenant. I mean, there's a lot of different ways of looking at a covenant, but there's a very special purpose that we're going to be looking at this morning about God's covenant with Israel and what it, exactly He was trying to accomplish, because I think He is trying to accomplish something, and it is related to our theme, and we're going to be emphasizing that. Let's back up just one minute here and talk a little bit about, again, some of the key elements and kind of piece them together. We talked about Genesis chapter 3, where there's sin created. That's the problem. Man and God are separated. Genesis chapter 12, God provides a promise to Abraham, which is the solution. And then the rest of the book of Genesis is really sort of the unfolding of that promise, where you have the birth of Isaac, the birth of Jacob, which is the son and grandson of Abraham, but the promise that God made to Abraham is also passed on through Isaac, on through Jacob. Jacob has 12 sons, and really that promise affects the whole tribes. Let's see, it looks like I disconnected, which is kind of weird. That's really strange. Let's see if it... I don't know, I'm frozen, guys. That's not the slide that I'm showing on my thing. Let me try to disconnect. Anyway, as we're trying to get that resolved, the rest of the book of Genesis is talking about that fulfillment. Israel journeys to Egypt. That's what we talked about last week. Their bondage in Egypt. And, of course, the story of Exodus, the beginning of Exodus, is their deliverance out of Egypt. And God delivers through the hand of Moses. He delivers them to eventually... conquering the Egyptians, and where does he take them? In other words, there's the real first place that God takes the people is where? Mount Sinai. And that's what we're going to be talking about right now in Exodus chapter 19. Okay? That's kind of... I don't know how I got a split screen there. Oh, well. I'm about to give up on the slides here. So you're just going to have to imagine. I'll try to portray this. But basically, in Exodus chapter 19, let's talk a little bit about what's going on here. Look at verses, beginning about verse 3. They're encamped just outside of Mount Sinai. They're at Mount Sinai for all practical purposes. And Moses goes up to God. And God is going to communicate to the people here. And we talked a little bit about this, but let's kind of re-look at it and emphasize some things. What Moses was to tell the people. In verse 4, Moses was to say to the people, "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and did what?" What did God do? There in verse 4. What did God do? What is the purpose of him bringing them to Mount Sinai? Exactly right. That's just a fascinating concept. God has been with them throughout this journey. Remember the pillar, the cloud pillar, the fire pillar, if you will, that God led them out of Egypt, directed their steps, if you will, but brought them to this place. But now... There's a greater sense in which they come to meet God. And so God brings them to himself. In verse 5, it says, "Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and do what? Keep my covenant." And so there's that idea of covenant, an agreement. Now that covenant is not in force yet, and we're going to talk about elements of that. But this is in prospect. This is God preparing the people for this covenant that he is about to make with them. And then he says, "You shall be," in other words, you do this, you obey my voice, you keep my covenant, "you shall be my treasure possessions among all the people, for all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." And it's that idea of creating out of Israel these people, a special people. And so somebody asked me a question Wednesday night, and I got to thinking about this, and I talked to Mary Kath a little bit about that, and I thought about the question, what's the difference right now? I mean, before this covenant is struck, what is the difference between the tribes of Israel, the people of Israel, and in any other nation on the earth? What is the difference? What's that? Well, let's think about that for just a second, Brother Lambert. Now, this is before the covenant, before the law has been instituted, before anything's done. Are the people of Israel idolatrous? Probably so. All right. So that at least at this point, that's not a difference because they're probably holding on to their idolatry. In fact, you do see that tendency later on, and you know when they construct the golden calf, they revert back to idolatry. So So that's not necessarily a difference. What can we think of any other differences? Or are they just like any other nation? I think perhaps there is one thing that they have that other nations don't have. And technically, they're not even a nation yet. They don't have a land. They don't have a law. All they have is what? The promise. That's exactly right. That's all they have. The promise of what God will fulfill. And that's important because, you know, some of the arguments that Paul makes later on, he talks about the fact that this promise was made to Abraham. And technically, Abraham was a Gentile when God made that promise. And the reason why that's important is that this promise of salvation was not just to Jewish people. It was really for all people. Now here, we are going to see let me see if I can get something going here. Yes, how about that? All right, they're delivered from bondage at this point that we saw, and now we're in Exodus chapter 19. All right. So it is the crafting of them becoming a special people. One other phrase I did want to look at in chapter 19, in verse 17, says, then Moses brought the people out of the camp specifically to meet God, and they took their stand at the foot of the mountain. So here they are at the foot of the mountain to meet God, and it's a tremendous scene. God descends like a fire on the mountain. There are trumpets, there are thunderings, and there are lightnings, and one of the things that the people were not to do was not to do what? Yeah, don't touch the mountain. Whatever you do, don't touch, or else what would happen? They would die. And that's going to be important because we're going to see a change in that after the covenant is established. And I kind of point it out now so that we'll look for it when we get to that. So here they are. They're about to meet God. And in chapter 20, you have the revealing of the what we normally call the Ten Commandments, which is the beginning of the law. And so we're going to talk about this law here in a few points. But just sort of a side note, how was the law in chapter 20, how was the law communicated to them? In other words, what was the means by which they heard it? Yeah, God's own voice. And I think God wanted them to hear His voice. You can just imagine for a moment what that might have been like for them to have heard the voice of God communicating this law. And toward the end of that chapter, what was their reaction of hearing God's voice? Yeah, we don't want to hear that. It's just too much for us. It's too frightening for us. So one of the points I think that we should probably understand from chapters 19 and 20 is that God, in many respects, was unapproachable. I mean, he brought them there to that point, but only up to that point. They couldn't touch the mountain. They couldn't get any closer to God. God's voice was terrifying to the people. It was not necessarily a comforting thing for them. And why do you think all that was? In other words, what was it that God was trying to portray to the people about Himself with all of this? I mean, the thunderings, the lightnings, the fire, the voice. What do you think he was trying to get across? His power. Okay, certainly. He is an all-powerful God. But to what kind of man? In other words, the powerful God in relationship to a sinful man, you know, where man, because of his sin, is terrified. And just think about the contrast that the New Testament makes about like in Hebrews chapter 10, we're actually encouraged to enter into the very presence of God without fear, without trembling, with full confidence because of what Christ has done. And so I do see a contrast between what we see here and what we see through Christ in the New Testament. So anyway, let's talk a little bit about the law and some things I think that are going on here. So at least in the Ten Commandments, we'll sort of look at primarily those for just a moment and not even go into great detail at this point anyway. But it's divided into two sections. The first section, which has laws pertaining to God, how man is to look at God. And, of course, the other thing, the last part of that, is basically laws pertaining how man is to interact with one another. But the whole of God's law, in essence, is to make a holy people. This is one of the things that will differentiate Israel from the rest of the nations. It is to create and to separate them from all others. And it's a law that is designed to be holy. And so there are a couple things I think that we can notice here, what the law does. First of all, the law defines their understanding of God. God is revealing himself. And the part of the law, in the Ten Commandments anyway, and other parts of the law as well, basically helps them understand who this God is, what he is, and how they are to relate to him. So, for example, in other words, when you look at the first commandment in chapter 20, what is the first command? Yeah. Which in essence says what about God? What does that say about who God is? Exactly right. There is really no other God. He is the only true God. Or perhaps the second commandment. What's the second command? Okay. Yeah. No graven image. Don't take anything, any type of material, and try to craft some type of image that you think represents God. Well, what does that say about God? Okay. Yeah. That he is spiritual. He can't be contained with physical elements, descriptions. You can't, God is not to be related in that particular way, to bring God down to man's level, if you will. He is truly a God. What else? In fact, there's something else that is interesting. Verse 5, you shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. God is, in that sense of jealousy, God is very protective about his relationship with his people and how they view other gods. In other words, he demands loyalty and allegiance and faithfulness only to him. And that's what the idea of jealousy is here. Verse 7 tells us another idea about God, another command. And what is that? Yeah. God is holy and is to be revered and treated as special. And that's the idea here. So, and there are other things too, not just here in the Ten Commandments, but there are other laws dealing with worship to God and that type of thing, that God is defining how man relates to God. Man doesn't get to decide that. It is up to God. It is on his terms that we come to man. And of course, one of the great examples of where man violated that is Nadab and Abihu, where they bring strange fire and God strikes them dead because they did something that was not authorized. They did something that God did not specify in order to approach them, which I think is a very important lesson. The second thing, or another thing that the law does, is that the law defines their understanding of man and how man is to relate to one another. So, for instance, kind of skipping the Sabbath for right now, we'll talk about that actually in another lesson. But the first, one of the first commands dealing with man's relationship to our fellow man is in verse 12, which is what? Yeah. So what does that say? What is God's expectation of man dealing with our parents, for example? In other words, what does that teach us about God's view of man and family? Absolutely right. Say that again, Brother Freddie. Okay, yeah, it's a special relationship. There are ways that we treat one another. And you kind of go through and look at that about murdering, adultery, stealing, false witness, coveting. You can see how all those things help us to understand the expectation that God has for man and how we are to relate with one another. I think it's a tremendously important thing. So God is defining for us our worldview or what He wants for man. And you look at I guess, chapters 21, 22, 23. There are other parts of this law that are I guess, communicated by Moses to the people. And there are various things. Slavery, sexual immorality, even like business things that are related there. Most of it has to do with mistreatment. Not to mistreat your neighbor. Don't take advantage of your neighbor. Those are the sort of the key things about that. But it also deals with justice. In other words, if these commands are broken, what you're supposed to do. A lot of these things have the death penalty attached to them. But typically the idea is an eye for an eye. In other words, if you hurt someone in a certain respect, then that's what's going to be required of you as a matter of punishment, is typically how justice was administered back in that day. So then we come to chapter 24, and that's where we're going to be focusing on for the remainder of our study this morning. The law is only one part of the covenant. The law is, in essence, basically God's expectation of what the people were to do. There's another part as well that blessings that God promises, and part of that's even in chapter 23, things that God will do for the people. But up to this point, just the reading of the law is the covenant hasn't been made yet. In other words, just because God gave the law to the people does not mean that the covenant is in force. That's why chapter 24, that's why we listed chapter 24 as one of the key passages, because this is where it's all put together and we see it accomplished. So let's look at some of the elements here. One of the first things in chapter 24, as we look at the covenant ratified, first couple of verses, basically God tells Moses to come to the Lord, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they're to worship from afar. And so now they approach God even more closely. In verse 3, Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord and the rules. And then, of course, the people answer back. How do they answer? In other words, after Moses tells them the law, how do the people respond? Okay, yeah. It's all the words that the Lord has spoken, we will do. And that, to me, that's interesting. You don't get the sense of the people said, no, that's too hard for us. We can't do that. we're not sure about some of these commands, whether or not we were able to be able to accomplish that. No, they heard those things, and they said, we will do this. In their minds, perhaps there's some innocence here. Perhaps they didn't completely understand what was involved. And I'm not suggesting that that's an excuse at all. But in their minds, they thought, we can do this. This is what God wants us to do. We'll do it. And you read through those things, and all of those things can be accomplished. Any one person can do those things. We'll talk about another reason, perhaps why we don't, why there's sin in the world, but it's not beyond impossible, I guess, is the point. In fact, it's very doable, seems to be going on here. So they answer back in verse 4, what does Moses do then with the words of the law? Yeah, he writes them down. I think that's important. To have some record of God's communication to the people and the writing it down. Eventually, at least the Ten Commandments are written on what? All right. How many stones? Okay? Yeah. Two. It doesn't specifically say that here, but later on in the book of Exodus, we see that, God had Moses write down the Ten Commandments on tablets of stone. And we know that there are two tablets of stone. Now, I want you to think about this for just a second. We're about to enter into a covenant. God's about to enter into a covenant between himself and Israel. Have you ever asked yourself the question, why two tablets of stone? You know, if you watch the movie, I forget the movie, Charlton Heston, you know, he has those tablets of stone. You know, you have five on one side, written in Roman numerals, which is, anyway. Five on one side, and then five on the other, right? And it's supposed to be the first five on one and five on the other. But perhaps, and just to get you thinking here about this, typically, when you enter into a contract with somebody, and you had that contract written, how many copies do you typically have, at least, at a minimum? Two. One for one party and one for the other party. Perhaps the idea of the multiple tablets of stones, or the two tablets of stone here, is that all the law, all the Ten Commandments anyway, are written on both. One to represent man and the other to represent God. Now perhaps, I'm only offering that as a perhaps here, but it certainly would be consistent with the idea of what's going on here, of bringing two parties together in this relationship. But they are written down, that we know. Then in verse 4, Moses rises early, and what does he build? What does the altar represent? What does it represent? Okay, to who? To God himself. In fact, I would suggest here that the altar represents God, not just the place of worship, but the altar itself. That is God's place, if you will. You know, any time that a sacrifice is offered upon an altar, you know, it talks about the aroma that goes up before God. But the altar itself represents God. And I'll show why I think that that's important here in just a moment. But he also, Moses does, builds what? In verse 4, there's the altar at the foot of the mountain, and then what comes next? How many? 12 pillars, which represent obviously what? All right, the tribes of Israel. So you have the 12 pillars that stand before this altar. And then the next thing that happens is, well, if you just try to imagine it, it kind of might make you sick to your stomach a little bit, but this is what happens. In verse 5, Moses sends young men of the tribe of Israel who offered burnt offerings and sacrificed peace offerings of the oxen to the Lord. And Moses took half the blood. So all the blood from these sacrifices that are made, he puts in basins. And so what does he do with the blood? Half the blood he does what? Okay, all right, yes. Yeah, he takes half the blood and he throws it against the altar. And then the remainder of the blood, the other half of the blood, what does he do with it? Okay, exactly right. Verse 7, it says he took the book of the covenant, that's what he wrote down, read it in the hearing of the people, and they said, all the people, all that the Lord has spoken we will do, and we will be obedient. So there's the reading of the law. So in other words, here's the contract, if you want to think in those terms. And after the reading, then the other half of the blood is sprinkled on the people. And I don't know how exactly that was done, whether all the people were sprinkled, if there were representatives there. But you think about what's going on. Half the blood is on the altar, which represents God. The other half is on the people themselves. The two parties involved are basically acknowledged that they are entering into this type of agreement. And so that blood is essential. And we'll talk more about this, about the nature of sacrifice. But in essence, I mean, why was blood necessary here? And the Hebrew writer talks about this in chapter 9. Why is blood necessary in order for this covenant, this agreement to be entered into? That's right. What's the problem we've been talking about? What is the problem that stands between God and man? Sin. What does blood do? Well, it provides forgiveness. There is no forgiveness unless there is the shedding of blood. And even here, even though these are animals, there is a type of forgiveness that is going on. And there is forgiveness. And we'll talk about why there is forgiveness when we talk about sacrifice in general. But then something remarkable happens. You thought, this is pretty strange in a lot of ways. I mean, we don't enter into agreements, but you know, there's a logical sense here. There's sin. God demands the shedding of blood. They enter into this agreement. But what happens next? What do they do next? It may be, if you haven't studied in a while, maybe completely unexpected. But something happens in verses 9 and following. All right, they saw God. Who specifically? Verse 9. Okay, yeah. Those individuals, which I think in essence represent the people, they saw the God of Israel. But there's something more. Something that we often miss here, but something else goes on, or in addition to that. Not only do they see God, but what else? Yeah, they eat a meal. Now, it doesn't say God specifically ate a meal, but they ate a meal in the presence of God. I think that is tremendously significant, and it really emphasizes the whole purpose of this covenant. About what God is saying, what God is wanting to accomplish with the people. Verse 11, they come before God, they see God, and what did God not do, first of all? He did not what? Yeah, he didn't strike them dead. Remember earlier he said, if you touch the mountain, I'm going to kill you, or you'll be killed, in essence. So now they have approached, they're on the mountain, and God did not strike them. Why? Well, because of the blood. They've entered into this covenant relationship. And not only did God not strike them, they enter into this meal, which I think, in essence, is a covenant meal. Let's explore that. Why a meal? Why would that be so important? You know, it's just a small little detail here, but I think it's tremendously important. Yes, Scott? Yeah, and historically that's true. The cultural norm of the day, and really for a long time before and after that, when parties entered into an agreement of sorts, they had a meal. But why a meal? In other words, what does that signify? What does that demonstrate, this meal together, God and man? Communion. Or, let's say it again, Brother Lambert. Yeah, togetherness. I mean, when you invite somebody over, do you invite your enemies over to your house to eat? Do you invite your friends over to eat? Well, friends, most of the time. We always have friends, you know, come over. Why? Because it's a time where we're able to share something, in this case, food, and to enjoy one another's company in an environment that is friendly to one another. And I think that that's what's being demonstrated. In other words, it symbolizes that God is not an enemy of the people anymore. There is no sin, at least at this point, no sin to separate them. And so they can enter into this fellowship in a manner of friendship, in agreement with one another. That's what the covenant really is all about. It's not, you know, sometimes we think of the covenant and it's the system of law. In other words, it's the law that God is wanting to establish. That's part of it. But really what God is trying to accomplish is this fellowship that he wanted with the people. Sin is the problem, and so what does he do? So let's talk about the purpose here for the few minutes. What God accomplishes is that he provided a way. God provided a way for God and man to enter into fellowship. But it is limited. In other words, this is not the full fellowship that God still has in mind that he wants to accomplish through Christ. Now, how is it limited? Can you think of any ways of why at this particular point God's fellowship with man is limited? Okay. Ultimately, that there's sin still really hasn't been completely dealt with. Animal sacrifice, and the Hebrew writer talks about this, animal sacrifice really don't take away sin, not ultimately. And we'll have some more to say about that. I think that's going to be a good conversation, a good study for us about what happens when man sacrificed, the expectations of that. So yes, that's part of the problem. Anyway, what else? How else is it limited? How about the scope of fellowship? Who all is in fellowship with God at this point? What people specifically? Yes, his people, but say that again, Brother Stevens. Israel. Are any other nations involved here? Are all the families of the earth blessed? In other words, has God fulfilled that promise yet? No, it's only Israel, and it's only limited to Israel. Now, can other nations enter into this relationship? Yes, people could enter into this covenant, but even then, they didn't have all that Israel had, but they had, in essence, become like Israel in some respects. But they couldn't enter into that. And we'll talk more about this, and I won't emphasize it here, but really, in the presence of God, is it complete? In other words, was Israel to have a full relationship with God? Well, no, because they still have certain hoops to jump through in order to enter into the presence of God. And even then, it's very, very limited. We'll really, really, really talk about that. So this is a limited fellowship. But is it more than what they had prior to the covenant? Absolutely. And that's what we're supposed to see here. Man has more access to God than he has had since sin entered into the world. And so you think about what... you're not going to be able to see this. I guess somehow I'm disconnected. Let's see if I can do this real quick. Okay. Think about what takes place next. In your Bibles, look, just turn the page in chapter 25. As soon as this covenant is established, God then begins to give a series of instructions on things, in essence, I believe, that helps facilitate this relationship. So in chapter 25, for instance, what does God command them to construct? Exactly right. And the elements that are part of the tabernacle. What's the purpose of the tabernacle? What else is it called besides? And I can have it up here in case you're wondering. What else is the tabernacle called? Yeah, the meeting place, the tent of meeting. And yeah, those things, you think about it, it is the place where man could meet God. So the very first thing he does after the covenant is provide a way in which they could meet God. Instead of having to go to Mount Sinai, they would have the tabernacle to be able to enter into the presence of God and all those things involved. Not only that, you continue in looking at some of the things that he talks about in chapter 28. He begins then talking in chapter 29. He establishes the priesthood, who are mediators between God and man. These are the men who will basically provide a way for man to be able to approach God. But man has to use the priesthood. They have to use the mediators in order to do that. Man still can't directly go to God themselves. And so the priesthood is established, and they are holy men. I mean, they are men who are consecrated. They are designated as special servants of God to be able to accomplish this. And that's tremendously important. There are certain requirements that they had to go through in order to be able to be those mediators. And then you look at I guess other parts of the law. Let's see. I guess you actually have to turn to the book of Leviticus. Talked about that. But then you have a whole, and we'll eventually talk about this, but it's the sacrificial system, which is the means by which they could have their sin forgiven. So there is a continual way for them to have forgiveness of sin so that they can continue in this relationship with God. The point that I'm trying to say here is that the covenant was a way for man and God to be together. God provided a way, and those are the three key elements: tabernacle, priesthood, sacrifice. And so for next Wednesday night, we're going to talk about the tabernacle, and then we'll look at the priesthood, and then we'll look at the sacrificial system and show why those are important. I think there's going to be some really good studies. Any last thoughts or comments before we stop this morning? Yeah. Exactly right. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, there are some changes involved there. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about the relationship between the old covenant and the new covenant. So that's a good point to make out. Any other thoughts, comments? All right, appreciate your attention this morning. We'll stop.